All right, so now we're going to do the lecture on oxygen transport, and we're going to be focusing on some things that affect cardiovascular structure. This comes from chapter 37. So these are going to be some of the things that we're going to go over. We're not going to do structural disorders because Ms. Lott went over that with you last week. So we'll do CAD, acute coronary syndrome, myocardial infarctions, and inflammatory disorders. So with coronary artery disease, which is also called CAD, we know that this is where overall those vessels within the heart, the vessels will start collecting with plaque. And so that plaque buildup is what's going to lead to the tissues not getting perfused properly and can end up leading to someone having a heart attack. So that plaque buildup is what we refer to as atherosclerosis. So in order to obtain adequate perfusion, the heart must accommodate the overall need of the body to generate enough cardiac output to supply blood to all the body tissues. Coronary artery disease negatively affects this function, leading to impaired cardiac output and decreased perfusion. So this is just a little patho about how atherosclerosis develops. So this is a major cause of coronary artery disease. And so what happens is those lipid deposits will start building up. Well, first the vessels will obtain a tear from something. And so one of the most common things is hypertension that will lead to that tear in the vessel. And that tear is going to try to heal, but in the midst of that, those lipid deposits will build up within that area where that tear was. And that's how plaque buildup begins. So just a little bit about it. Endothelial injury and inflammation plays a key role in the development of atherosclerosis. So that's the picture A, like I was just referring to. So any of those conditions will lead to that local inflammatory response taking place where it tries to heal itself. So something, a lab value that's common that we see with inflammation is going to be your CRP, your C-reactive protein. And so this is going to rise along with lipoproteins, especially in patients that have coronary artery disease. So we can start to see whenever that inflammation begins in those vessels. Coronary artery disease is something that develops over a period of time, over years, before the patient becomes symptomatic. The stage is usually at an advanced level. So picture B shows you what's called a fatty streak. And so this is where they will start to have that build up in those vessels. And so usually at this point, they try to do treatments to lower the low density lipoproteins, which are very important with high cholesterol. Picture C just kind of shows you a fibrous plaque. So this is going to cover that lipid pore. And this is just where the actual vessel will become narrowed at this point because blood flow is going to be coming through that tight space because it's narrow. So blood flow can be reduced to distal tissues with vessels that are like that. And then D is your most dangerous stage. So this is where that plaque is going to continue to grow. And that continued inflammation results in an instability, ulceration, and rupture. And so that is how a little clot can like rupture off and end up causing someone to have like a heart attack or something. So in patho, you guys learned about collateral circulation, the process of angiogenesis. So whenever someone starts having plaque buildup in those vessels, the heart is very unique because those vessels will start developing through angiogenesis, where it creates new blood vessels to reroute blood flow just so it can keep perfusing the heart. But overall, some of those arteries do become occluded in the end. So when we're thinking about coronary artery disease, we look at the modifiable and the non-modifiable factors. So non-modifiable are things that you have no control over, things that cannot be changed. And then your modifiable are actual things that the patient can do to better their health and change so that they don't end up with coronary artery disease. So our major modifiable factors are going to be with lipids and hypertension. So having a high serum lipid level is a major risk factor for coronary artery disease. So when we're looking at those different things, your lipoproteins. So your lipoproteins are going to be considered your vehicles for fat mobilization and transport. And we have three types, your HDL, LDLs, and VLDLs. Your HDLs are your good lipoprotein. So they absorb cholesterol, carry it back to the liver, and then the liver is going to flush it from the body. So having high levels of HDL can ultimately lower risk of heart disease and even stroke. Your LDLs are your bad lipoproteins. So they make up most of your body's cholesterol, and high levels of those risk you for heart disease and stroke. And so buildup of those LDLs also on the walls are what causes plaque to build up. And then you have your VLDLs, which is your very low density lipoproteins. They have a higher concentration of triglycerides, and they can deposit directly on the walls of those arteries. Hypertension is also important because the shear and stress of having that elevated blood pressure is what can lead to that endothelial injury from the very beginning. So these are just showing you your different stages of high blood pressure and what it can do to those vessels. Tobacco use, physical inactivity, and obesity. So nicotine and tobacco, this causes catecholamine release. So your epinephrine, norepinephrine. So this causes tachycardia and hypertension. So this is how tobacco can end up leading to someone developing CAD. Of course, not exercising, and then being overweight as well. There are other contributing and modifiable risk factors as well. So having diabetes, because of that, the changes in how lipids are metabolized, and usually diabetic patients have a higher cholesterol and triglyceride level. So this is why they're at risk. Metabolic syndrome. Metabolic syndrome is just when you have a little bit of everything going on. So you're obese, you have hypertension, you have abnormally high lipids, and a high fasting blood glucose. That's metabolic syndrome. Certain psychological states, so being depressed, having a lot of stress on the body, anxiety, hostility, anger, lack of social support, those all play a part in causing the body to activate that fight or flight where they're overly stimulated, releasing those catecholamines, increasing blood pressure. So those are all things that can lead to coronary artery disease. Homocysteine, this along with CRP and lipoprotein, so high levels of both can lead to CAD. And so this is just a breakdown of amino acid, the essential amino acid methionine, which is found in protein. Methionine. Substance abuse, so use of illegal drugs and methamphetamine, so all of that places a lot of stress on the heart, with tachycardia, hypertension, and chest pain. So with managing and treatment coronary artery disease, management and treatment of coronary artery disease, we do have some guided recommendations for patients that need to be treated. So if they have a known diagnosis of coronary vascular disease, if they have elevations in any of those lipids, or if they're diabetic, or just depending on age, those patients, they're recommended that they be treated for coronary artery disease. So for physical activity, table 37.3 just kind of talks about a formula that they recommend for patients to go by. It's called the FIT formula. And so FIT stands for frequency, intensity, type, and time. So 30 minutes most days plus weight training 2 days a week. This is going to help with reducing weight, reducing blood pressure, and increasing those HDL cholesterol levels. As far as nutritional therapy, we want to make sure that they're reducing saturated fats and cholesterol, and increasing complex carbs and fiber. We also want them to reduce red meat, egg yolks, and whole milk, and increase in omega-3 fatty acids. Those are some recommendations. So drug therapy for coronary artery disease, of course, these patients are going to be placed on treatments that's focusing on high cholesterol levels and lowering those LDL cholesterol levels. So usually if the patient has had known coronary artery disease, but no clinical events, they're going to treat them with a high dose statin lipid lowering agent to reduce the LDLs by 50%. There are some drug alerts with certain medications. I'll talk a little bit about some of them. So with simvastatin, we know that statins inhibit the synthesis of cholesterol in the liver. And gemfibrozil is a medication that increases risk for rhabdo. So that's something that needs to be noted of. Niacin, which is a water-soluble vitamin that lowers LDLs, it can cause flushing of the skin. So if the patient is taking that, they need to be aware of that side effect. Gemfibrozil also increases risk of bleeding in patients who are already taking warfarin. So patients that's on that medication need to be careful. As far as antiplatelet therapy, low dose aspirin is going to be recommended for someone who has CAD. And then if they can't tolerate low dose aspirin, so if they have like history of GI bleeds, then clopidogrel, which is Plavix, is going to be an option for those that are intolerant to aspirin. So as far as patient and caregiver teaching, table 37.2 just kind of talks a little bit about how to educate those patients on things that they need to do to better their health in those specific situations. Gerontologic considerations. So age and inactivity and tobacco use are going to be high risk factors for those who are older in age, resulting in coronary artery disease. So they're going to be aggressively treating hypertension and hyperlipidemia so that they can stabilize those plaques and those arteries from rupturing. So key things are going to be making sure that they, you educate them on tobacco cessation and physical activity to kind of help with decreasing their disease from developing. So now we're going to hop into talking about acute coronary syndrome. So acute coronary syndrome is prolonged chest pain from ischemia that's not immediately reversible. So we will start to see this with someone if they start experiencing chronic stable angina, and it can lead to ACS. So there are different perspectives of ACS, and we're going to talk about the specifics, but pretty much the previously stable plaque will rupture, releasing that lipid core into the vessel, and this causes platelet aggregation and thrombus formation. So the vessels may either be partially blocked by a thrombus, and it'll manifest as either unstable angina or a non-STEMI, or if it's totally blocked by a thrombus, it'll manifest as a STEMI. And we're going to talk about those on the next couple of slides. It's very important if patients come in complaining about chest pain, because the heart muscle can start to become hypoxic within that first 10 seconds of those vessels being occluded. So that's why if they come in and complain of chest pain, they take it very serious, because if they do need to go to the cath lab for revascularization, it has to be done quickly. If it's past 20 minutes, the patient will start to have irreversible heart damage that can't be repaired. So that's why they work pretty quick. Unstable angina. So patients with chronic stable angina, an angina is chest pain, they may develop unstable angina. And so usually this is the first clinical sign of someone presenting with coronary artery disease. So patients with previously diagnosed chronic stable angina will describe a significant change in the pattern of their chest pain. So with unstable angina, it occurs with increase in frequency. It's easily provoked by minimal exertion during sleep or even at rest. That's what makes it a little bit different. So patients that already have chronic stable, that means they have that chest pain that's not so bad and it just goes away as long as they're rest. But unstable angina is different. So it lasts longer and it's done during times where they're not even provoking themselves to have chest pain. So with unstable angina, we will see some electrocardiogram changes on the ECG. So they will either have an ST depression or a T wave inversion. And so I have some pictures here just kind of showing you what that will look like. So this is what an ST depression looks like and a T wave inversion. So this is going to be related with unstable angina. You will see these specific ECG changes with this type of chest pain. And so that lets us know that there are ischemic changes. So that heart muscle is getting decreased oxygenation. That's what that means. So a myocardial infarction, which I will refer to as an MI, which is a heart attack. This occurs because of an abrupt stoppage of blood flow through a coronary artery with a thrombus caused by platelet aggregation, causing irreversible myocardial cell death in the heart muscle. Beyond the blockage, serum cardiac markers are going to be released into the blood. So that's what happens with a heart attack. So the chest pain is very intense, and at this point, the actual heart muscle will start to die due to either of these factors. So, with a heart attack, you can have two types. You can have a non-STEMI and a STEMI. And so, a non-STEMI is a non-ST segment elevation myocardial infarction. So, with the non-STEMI, the patient may have, they may or may not show an ST depression or T wave inversion. So the leads, and we would look for this in the leads that's facing that area of infarction. So with the non-STEMI, they usually don't have to do thrombolytic therapy. It's not indicated. Versus with a STEMI, which is your ST segment elevation myocardial infarction, we're going to see ST elevation in the ECG leads that's facing the area where that infarction is on the heart. So with the ST elevation, it's going to be very significant. And what I mean by that is on the EKG, that elevation is going to be 1 millimeter or more above that isoelectric line. And we're going to see it in at least two neighboring leads. So two leads that are right by each other. So if someone has a STEMI, that artery needs to be reopened and within 90 minutes of presentation of their symptoms in order for them to restore blood flow and oxygen to that heart muscle. It also will decrease the size of that infarct because if you have one little spot of dead heart muscle, it will spread to the rest if that vessel isn't opened back up. So that's the purpose of our percutaneous intervention, which is called PCI. This is where they'll go in the cath lab and they'll open it up with a balloon or place a stent, and then they'll do the thrombolytic therapy as well. If they're at a facility that is not equipped to do the heart cath there, they'll treat them with the thrombolytic therapy first and then transfer them to a facility that can put them on the table and do the PCI. So let's talk about an echocardiogram. This is just the ultrasound of the heart. And so for someone, well, really for both, they'll see hypokinesis, and that's just worsening myocardial contractility. And then akinesis is where there's absent myocardial contractility in that necrotic area. So usually they can kind of see and pinpoint where that infarction is with an echocardiogram as well. If someone has a non-STEMI, they're not rushed to the cath lab. They usually wait 12 to 72 hours before they take them to the cath lab, because usually they become stable after the fact. But for STEMI, they need to go to the cath lab within 90 minutes. They have to be, intervention has to be taking place within 90 minutes of them presenting with their symptoms. So with the myocardial infarction, the tissue of the heart that is the earliest to become ischemic is going to be that subendocardium. And so most heart attacks are going to affect the left ventricle. And so they're usually described based on the location of damage. So whenever someone has a heart attack and they go in and do intervention, they classify where on the heart it is. So either anterior, inferior, lateral, septal, or a posterior wall infarction is how they would classify it. So table 33, maybe it's 37.14. That table kind of lets you know how you will see ECG changes and how to pinpoint MI based off of the location. You don't have to know that, but that's just if you ever wonder how they know exactly where, that table will let you know that. So let's talk about these pictures right here. So this first picture is showing you how this LAD, which is the left anterior descending coronary artery, this is the blockage that occurred with the MI. And so that artery is occluded, causing a myocardial infarction. So like this heart muscle will become ischemic because these coronary arteries, they provide blood flow to all of that tissue. So if this artery is blocked, can it adequately give it oxygenated blood? No, it cannot. So number two here is just kind of showing you the wall of someone that has had a heart attack, a previous one and a new one. So the white arrow right here is showing you absence of staining in this area. And then this the black arrow right here is showing you from a previous heart attack. And so this is what like a fresh heart attack kind of look like. So picture three right here is showing you how they can pinpoint areas of those arteries and where that blockage would be based off of the leads on the EKG. And so this is where those certain leads look at for that heart attack. And that's what I can kind of pinpoint. If someone has a heart attack, that's going to be very important for them to kind of pinpoint where, so they'll know whenever they take them to the cath lab where they need to intervene in. So these pictures just kind of help explain it for you. This right here is showing someone that has had an anterior septal lateral wall MI. So it's the arrows are just showing you where the ST segment elevation is. And so with it being them looking at those different leads, it's letting you know where exactly on the heart that blockage was. So you'll see that that's what an ST elevation looked like. And these V2 and V3, see how they're, these are what we call neighboring leads. So if you're going to see those elevations, you have to see it in neighboring leads. And these are all leads that are right by each other. This right here is another one, kind of showing you an ST with changes to the ST segment as well. So manifestations for someone presenting with a heart attack. So of course they're going to be complaining of chest pain, and it's unrelieved by rest. If they position change or after getting nitroglycerin, they're still having chest pain. Some of them also complain of epigastric pain. So a lot of people end up with not a good outcome because they misinterpret it for heartburn, so indigestion. So they take those antacids and they still don't have relief, and they just think, oh, it's just chest pain. We see that common with a lot of men as well. During this time, these patients will also have this pain while they're resting. They may be asleep and it'll wake them up. Nausea and vomiting. Severe pain can cause that reflex where they start throwing up, and in older patients will actually see a change in their mental status. Women and men both kind of have different pain complaints as well. Women sometimes they'll complain of just discomfort altogether. They'll feel more tired. And again, this pain is lasting longer than the few minutes. It's usually more than 20 minutes that they're complaining of this pain. As far as the sympathetic nervous system, everything is going to be up with them. So they're sweating, heart rate's up, blood pressure's up, their skin is going to be clammy and cool to touch. And from a cardiovascular standpoint, if it continues to go without any intervention, their blood pressure will drop because they're going to have decreased cardiac output. They can start going into heart failure and showing heart failure symptoms. So whether it's affecting the left ventricle or the right ventricle, depending on where the dysfunction is, they'll show those different signs of heart failure. Just kind of depends on where that infarction is. Different complications of having a heart attack. So of course, dysrhythmias is going to be your most common complication that we will see. So VTAC and VFib, most common cause of death, usually will occur within the first 4 hours after that onset of pain. These patients can also develop deadly bradycardia, such as complete third degree, complete heart block in those areas that are destroyed. They may start developing those PVCs, if, especially if they go for reperfusion. And so those are things that we definitely need to be on the lookout for. Heart failure, again, depending on which side of the heart is affected. And so it affects which ventricle. So left side, your left side, they're going to show the signs of fluid building up in the lungs and them not being able to breathe, versus right side, the blood is backing up out of the system. So JVD, hepatic congestion, extremity edema. Cardiogenic shock, especially if the heart is deprived of that oxygen for too long, so the heart can start failing and going into shock. So the goal is going to be to make sure we're maximizing oxygen, reducing that O2 demand, and preventing further complications. Papillary muscle dysfunction or rupture, this can occur at that infarcted area. Is right near that papillary muscle. So, how we would know if this happened, we will hear like a new systolic murmur that would let us know, and it's confirmed by an echocardiogram. A left ventricular aneurysm. So, the infarcted heart wall becomes thin and it'll bulge out whenever the heart is contracting. And so, this aneurysm can develop, and it's dangerous because it can lead to them ended up having a stroke from a emboli, or that blood becoming stagnant in the area. Another complication is a ventricular wall rupture. Pericarditis. Pericarditis is very common, and so this can appear 2 to 3 days after having a heart attack. And so the patient is going to have mild to severe chest pain. It's going to be worse as they take a breath in, coughing and movement of the upper body. So the only way they get relief is if they sit in a forward position with pericarditis. Treatments for this, and we're going to talk more about it later in the slide, but treatment is going to be with high doses of aspirin, NSAIDs, and they really want to avoid corticosteroids. Because it can interfere with scar formation, so they avoid the steroids. So they usually do aspirin, NSAIDs. Dressler syndrome. So they'll develop pericarditis, fever, 1 to 8 weeks after having this MI, and it's just an autoimmune reaction to that necrotic heart muscle. So the patient's gonna have like chest pain, fever. They're gonna experience that pericardial friction rub that we're gonna talk about. And their white count is going to be high, their SID rate's going to be high, and they're going to have the only treatment for Dressler is high dose aspirin. That's the treatment for it. So your ECG is going to be very important in maintaining someone with diagnosing someone with an MI, because again, that's what we're going to look at to see where we see those changes. So it can help diagnose between unstable angina or an MI. Because again, we're going to see changes with the ST segment or the T wave. It's going to let us know by injury, ischemia, and infarction, and where is it. So STEMI patients, they have a complete coronary occlusion, remember, and so we're going to see that ST elevation in those leads facing the wall that's infarcted on the first 12 lead EKG that we do on them. Patients with a non-STEMI or unstable, they'll have transient thrombosis or an incomplete occlusion. So they won't be completely occluded, but they may have an ST depression or a T wave inversion where the infarction is. So your cardiac biomarkers also are going to be very important, and that's your troponin, CK-MB, and myoglobin. So, this is also going to help distinguish if they're having an unstable angina or non-STEMI, because if someone is having a non-STEMI, the biomarkers will be high, versus if someone is having unstable angina, the cardiac biomarkers are going to be normal. And so those biomarkers, they are proteins that are going to be released into the blood from that necrotic heart muscle after having an MI. And so your troponin is usually the key one that we use to look at someone having an MI. And so they have different types. Usually they do the troponins every 6 hours times a set of three, where they do it three times. For cardiac catheterization, this is going to be your percutaneous PCI, percutaneous intervention. So for a STEMI, they need to be cath within 90 minutes of presentation and have the thrombolytic therapy within 30 minutes. So agencies, like I said, agencies that don't have the capability to do a heart cath need to give that thrombolytic within 30 minutes. The goal is to open up that totally occluded artery and limit the size of the infarction. So when I say PCI and cardiac cath, those are pretty much the same thing, where they go to the cath lab, assess the blockage, and determine, what's the necessary thing that they need to do. So during that time, the physician may want to go in and put in a stent. And so they have different types of stents. So they have a bare metal one, and then they have a drug-eluting one that they'll put in that block artery. So the drug-eluting one, of course, will release medication over time to make sure that no plaque or anything is building up in there. So depending on what they find, some patients may have severe left ventricle dysfunction and may need to be placed on an intra-aortic balloon pump. After that PCI, and it's just where that balloon pump is going to kind of help keep everything open. And they also may put them on dobutamine to kind of help with their heart function. Usually, some patients, when they go in for a cath lab, the damage is too severe, and so the physician will, well, it's usually cardiologists will recommend that they have open heart surgery to have those vessels fixed, where they create new vessels because those vessels are just, too stenosed, and they can't go in there and fix it. So, an advantage of having emergent PCI is that it allows for faster reperfusion to again limit that infarction size. It provides an alternative to the surgical intervention, and usually is performed under local anesthesia. So, the patients are usually ambulatory after they've done like their necessary bed rest, freshly out of the cath lab. And the length of stay in the hospital is very short. Some patients come in for a heart cath and leave the same day, and some stay just for a few days, just depending on how bad the situation is. But there are risks with having PCI because sometimes physicians go in and they may cause a dissection or rupture of those arteries. The artery may collapse. They may have a stent thrombosis where that stent clots off. And just sometimes they can't go in and open it up. So that's where they'll result to open heart surgery instead. Thrombolytic therapy is going to be very important. This is used when agencies don't have the interventional cardiac catheterization lab or when one is too far to get the patient there quick enough. So the thrombolytic has to be given within 30 minutes of them coming into the ED. Inclusion therapy, so indications where they will need it is their chest pain has been less than 12 hours. They have 12-lead ECG findings consistent with a STEMI, and they have no absolute contraindications. So table 37.16, and I definitely want you guys to know the contraindications for thrombolytic therapy because we can't give this to everybody. Patients that are at risk for bleeding out, someone that may have had a recent head injury, someone that has uncontrolled hypertension, those are patients that we would not let them be given a thrombolytic medication because it can cause a stroke, hemorrhagic stroke, because they'll bleed out. So signs, we need to be aware of safety measures after a thrombolytic therapy is administered. So ma signs of major bleeding are if they have a drop in blood pressure, heart rate goes up, change in mental status, they start bleeding in the urine or stool. Those are things that are major bleeding instances. Minor bleeding is gingival bleeding, where the gums are bleeding, or if they start bleeding from their IV sites. So this is expected because, again, this is a clot buster. It's a thrombolytic. It's thinning our blood, so that minor bleeding is fine. It's expected, but we can control it. So we control it by applying manual pressure, by using a pressure dressing or ice packs if that instance happened. As far as nutritional therapy, when patients come in with chest pain, they like to keep them NPO because if they're going down to the cath lab and they have to get some local anesthesia, it can mess with their stomach. So they usually don't like for them to put anything on their stomach. Drug therapy for MIs, your number one medication is nitroglycerin. And we usually have patients start off with nitroglycerin first. But the total of medication that they're going to be given is usually aspirin, nitroglycerin, atorvastatin, and then for a STEMI, they need systemic anticoagulation with either sub-Q low me molecular weight heparin, and then they usually do IV heparin only for unstable angina and non-STEMI patients. So those are our options. Nitro, first choice. So again, remember we could do a sublingual. And usually if the patient comes by EMS, they'll give them some sublingual nitro, or they usually the patients, if they have it on hand, they will take that first. But we do sublingual until we notice that that's not working, then we can switch to IV nitroglycerin. So nitro is going to work by decreasing the preload and afterload, and it also increases that O2 supply. So we have to titrate it according to their chest pain. So if they continuously having chest pain, we have to titrate and go up. Most common side effect of nitro is going to be hypotension. So we need to make sure that we're monitoring the blood pressure. If the chest pain is unrelieved by nitro, the next step would be is morphine. And so morphine is not given for pain purposes. It's given to work as a vasodilator because it decreases the workload on the heart. It makes the heart not have to consume so much oxygen. And so it's going to decrease the blood pressure and heart rate, but we also need to make sure we're monitoring for signs of decreased respirations and hypotension as well. Beta blockers. So beta blockers, they help with decreasing the O2 demand as well, but it's also going to reduce heart rate, blood pressure, and contractility. ACE inhibitors and ARBs. So these should be started within the first 24 hours only if the blood pressure is stable and they have no contraindications. The purpose of starting them on this is to help prevent ventricular remodeling because we don't want the ventricle to change after going through that stressful time with the that infarcted tissue. So it's going to prevent remodeling, and also it slows them from progressing to heart failure. Antidysrhythmic drugs, because we know that dysrhythmias are very common, and then they're going to be on a lipid-lowering agent indefinitely. So they definitely have to start them on that because that's what kind of led up to it anyway. Stool softeners are also going to be important because if they are on bed rest initially when they come out, and they're going to be taking those different opioid drugs, we don't want them to become constipated. So after someone has a heart attack, these are some of the recommendations that they have for them. Just kind of talking about staying active. They're always going to be enrolled in some type of cardiac rehabilitation program. And then they have to take extra measures with resuming sexual activity, especially for men that kind of use what's that drug that they use to help with like any sexual enhancement drugs, because they can interfere with the heart. So now we're going to talk about inflammatory disorders, and there are three that we're going to talk about, and these come from chapter 40. So the first one is ineffective endocarditis. And so this is where that inner layer, the innermost layer of the heart, which is the endocardium, which makes up that inner layer in the heart valve, so where it becomes inflamed. So there are different causes, and it's classified based off of the cause that leads to it. But with i.e., it can be either subacute or acute. So subacute is it that it affects those with pre-existing bowel disease that have had it over a period of months, and then acute is rapidly progressive onset of those with those bowels becoming affected. So what happens with i.e., the blood flow allows organisms to contact and infect previously damaged heart valves over those endothelial surfaces. So usually either Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, any of those bacteria will go to the heart and affect the valves. And so common risk factors include someone that has like valve disease, cardiomyopathy, if they've had IE before, non-cardiac conditions are going to be bacteremia. So if they have severe bacteria in their blood from septic shock. IV drug use is one of the most common ones as well. And so just a little bit about the patho, IE has three stages. So what happens is vegetations, these are going to be the primary lesions. They consist of fibrin, leukocytes, platelets, and microbes. They are going to stick to the valve surface or the endocardium. And the loss of parts of these fragile vegetations will end up resulting in emboli. And so this will lead to those vegetations going to different organs in the body, and it could lead to decreased blood flow. So that it starts off with having the bacteria in the blood, and then, like we said, those fibrin and everything will stick together, and then the vegetation is what breaks off, leading to them developing this very bad infection in the heart. So manifestations, they're usually nonspecific and they involve multiple organ systems. So majority of these patients appear with a fever. And they can also have like chills, weakness, malaise, fatigue, anorexia, a muscle pain. They can complain of back pain, abdominal discomfort, and clubbing of the fingers. So remember I was saying some of those little vegetations can branch off and go to different parts of the body. So that's where we'll start to see the vascular signs. So one of the first one is the splenic hemorrhages that you see right here. And these are black longitudinal streaks in the nail beds. And this is petechiae from microembolization of those vegetative lesions. So we'll start to see areas such as conjunctivae, the lips, the buccal mucosa, the palate over the ankles, feet, the AC area, the popliteal areas. We'll start to see some discoloration in those areas as well. Osler's nodes, these are these little things. They look like little pricks that they may have been pricked on their hands and stuff. These are painful, tender red or purple pea-sized lesions. Janeway lesions, these are flat, painless, small red spots on the fingertips, the palms, the soles of their feet and toes. Roth spots, these are hemorrhagic retinal lesions that they'll have in their eyes. And then they can even develop a new or worsening systolic murmur as well. A complication of this condition is septic embolism. One of those vegetatives can go and result in this clot, and they can become septic from it. So to diagnose someone with this, they refer to the Duke criteria. And so the Duke criteria is, and I'm going to go over some of them, but what they're looking at when they're assessing a patient is going to be a history and physical. So they're going to ask if they've had any recent dental, urologic, surgical, or gynecologic procedures in the past 3 to 6 months, including having a baby. They're going to draw some blood cultures over a period of 1 hour from three different sites. Usually these patients are going to have their ESR that edit the sedimentation rate, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and the C-reactive protein are going to be increased. They're going to be able to see that vegetation if they do an echo. But the Duke criteria is that the patient must have two major criteria or one minor criterion, or one major and three minor. So when we're looking at those different things, they have to have like a positive blood culture. They have to been identified the typical microorganism for IE on two separate blood cultures, evidence of the endocardium being involved in new valvular vegetation. That's some of the major criteria. The minor criteria, this is if they already have a predisposing heart condition, if they've done IV drugs before, if they have microbiologic evidence or echocardiographic findings consistent with ID but not meet major criteria. So managing someone with this condition, prophylactic treatment is going to be very important. So any people with heart conditions need to receive prophylactic antibiotics. And then conditions are procedures that's requiring antibiotics prophylactically, so oral procedures, respiratory infections, surgical procedures, they need to make sure that the patients are being educated on making sure they complete those antibiotics. Drug therapy. So the key thing is going to be to figure out what the cause of aging is that led to it. These patients, they're going to be on treatments for a very long time, especially antibiotics. So these patients are usually discharged home on IV antibiotics. And so they're going to base the antibiotics based off whatever the blood cultures resulted. These patients usually require for implementations, they require antibiotics for about 4 to 6 weeks. They usually stay in the hospital for a little while and then they discharge them home with like a PICC line, and they'll have like a home health nurse to come and start their antibiotics, depending on how frequently they would have to have them. But education purposes, we need to make sure that the patient understands the importance of monitoring their temperature, because a persistent temperature lets us know that the antibiotics are not working. We also need to make sure family reports any sudden changes in their mental status. If they have like chest pain, dyspnea, unexplained weight gain, they need to report those things because it could mean that they're getting worse. It's also going to be important to educate on periods of physical and emotional rest because their body is going to be already stressed out. So they need to make sure that they're adequately resting. Acute pericarditis is our next condition that we're going to talk about. And this is where the pericardium is affected. And so, your pericardium is composed of the visceral and parietal layers, and there's a space between it that holds about 10 to 15 mils of serous fluid. And so that prevents the heart from any developing any friction from it pumping. So this is where that infection will take place in the area that has that fluid. So it could be acute, subacute, or chronic. And the manifestations are these patients are going to have very progressive, severe, and sharp chest pain. And it's worse when they're breathing in and laying flat. So if the patient sits up and leans forward, the pain is relieved. That pain can also start to radiate to areas like the neck, arms, and the left shoulder, making it hard to distinguish from angina. But the best way to be able to distinguish if it's just regular chest pain or if it's pericarditis chest pain is if they complain of that pain in their shoulder and upper back. So if they say it's the shoulder and upper back, that lets us know that it's pericarditis. One of the hallmark findings, so one of the key things that diagnoses of pericardial acute pericarditis is going to be that pericardial friction rub. And so it's going to be like a scratching, grating, high-pitched sound. And the best place to hear it is going to be the lower left sternal border of the chest. But the patient needs to be leaning forward whenever this is done to listen at that sound. Complications of having this is going to be a pericardial effusion because, again, that buildup of fluid in the pericardium and that effusion can compress those structures. And so it's going to be very important to manage that because if that buildup keeps coming, it'll squeeze the heart, leading to a tamponade. And so the cardiac tamponade is also a complication where that effusion has increased and increased and is compressing the heart, squeezing the heart. And so the patient can't breathe. They're anxious, restless, and complaining of chest pain. Heart sounds are going to be muffled. The neck veins are going to be distended. And so those classic features are referred to as what we call Beck's triad. So they'll have multiple heart cells, jugular vein distension, and pulsus paradoxus. And pulsus paradoxus is just where their systolic blood pressure drops tremendously whenever they breathe in. So those are the three key signs of a cardiac tamponade. So when we're diagnosing this condition, we're going to be looking for, these patients will have ST elevations diffusely widespread. So remember we said with the MI, you're going to see them in neighboring leads. Well, with someone with pericarditis, we'll see ST elevations diffusely, meaning ever so often throughout the ECG. Also, we can do an echocardiogram that will be able to help them diagnose the pericardial effusion or the tamponade. And so treatments for this, they have different things. They can do antibiotics if it's bacterial pericarditis, NSAIDs to help with controlling pain and inflammation. If the patients don't respond to the NSAIDs, they can do corticosteroids, but only if they don't respond to NSAIDs. Colchicine, so the medication that they give for gout, this can also help with recurrent pericarditis so that they don't get, if they keep getting it, colchicine will help with recurrency of it so that they don't keep getting it. Different treatments they can do with pericardiocentesis, so very similar to thoracentesis, where they draw off the excess fluid from around the heart in that pericardial area. But these patients need to be placed on volume expanders and any inotropic agents prior to the procedure, because anytime you draw off any fluid from someone, you want to make sure that volume is established. They can do a pericardial window. That's a surgical procedure where they'll go in and cut a window in the pericardium to allow the fluid to drain into the peritoneum or the chest cavity. Nurse management, we're going to be managing pain and anxiety is going to be key. Pain relief measures, keeping the patient on bed rest. Their head of the bed needs to be raised to 45 degrees and make sure they have their overhead table for support. So our last condition is myocarditis. And so this is just where the muscle of the heart is inflamed. So these patients, their manifestations are going to present as progressive heart failure. They're also going to be showing the signs of infection with fever, fatigue, malaise. Their muscles going to be hurting. And usually we'll see this early cardiac signs 7 to 10 days after they've had a viral infection. And so in that instance, they'll have both pericarditis and myocarditis, where they can have both. So as far as the late cardiac signs, we'll see those signs of heart failure. They have JVD, syncope, edema, angina, and diagnostic studies. So these patients can have dysrhythmias and issues with their conduction, with their impulses, simply because, you know, we know the myocardium is very important. We're making sure that the conduction of the impulses are done properly, because that's where they originate from. So we'll definitely see some issues there. Treatment-wise, ACE inhibitors and beta blockers are going to be the key medications that we use. They're also going to use diuretics to help reduce with fluid volume and preload. They can start them on nitroprusside to help with reducing afterload, and then digoxin can help increase cardiac contractility and reducing the heart rate. So when we're managing this, what we're trying to do is improve their cardiac output and manage those signs of heart failure. So these patients need to be placed in semifowlers, making sure that we space activities, because they can get overworked up too quick. Make sure they have an adequate rest periods and providing a quiet environment for them. And this concludes the cardiac lecture.